The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I am so delighted that you're here tonight. I've rarely gotten as excited as I did when I got my hands on your book. It's at once a lyrical splendor, and there is this attention to syllabic, like at an atomic level, like syllabic, sonic detail. It's a structural feat. So I wanted to ask, before we get into the conversation, if you might read poem two, Invocative, to start
sure.
us off.
Thank you. And it's such an honor to be here with you.
I'm so happy you're here.
And thank you, everyone, for coming out. So the title of the poem as a book is 36 Ways of Writing a Vietnamese Poem, and each of the titles is one of the ways. So this is two. Invocative, apostrophic. To you, mind you, always, even if not or not facially, your language, your leash, my face, my pedigree. And you know I know my face. To a fault, to the ninth degree. Whatever I write is Vietnamese. I can never not, you won't let me not, lick the leash or bite it. Even at the end of my brain and yours, said transplanted lawns, outwash plains, son life, I am this face, no more. Whereas you are the living palm, the wind, the phoenix song, the house in my head I name home. Though where I'm really from, the dead bird stays dead.
What a way to enter into a collection where you start with the rhetorical device of the apostrophe, in which we know that there's a person off frame that's being talked about or talked to. And so we have someone or something not present. So that enters us as readers directly into this text where we know that you're in conversation with someone or something just outside of the frame, but still very present. Thank you for that. I was thinking about, you can't seem to confront the writer's relationship with the world without also interrogating the relationship with the self or the family of origin or place of origin. And in all of your work, the relationships enter the text and suggest the same. So I'm wondering, when did you give yourself permission to question your formative landscape, even your roots, your places of origin? And did you approach with wonder? Or did you approach with fear?
Oh, that's a good one. I think there were so many entry points and so many stations along the line of that interrogation. And some of them were inflected by different things. For example, some might have been inflected by culture or by like the particular climate of reticence in our family, of things not said, of things avoided or evaded. And part of it might have come more deliberately from writing into this material, into this wound, as you say, and encountering all of the pockets of inertia and bad faith that can happen when you're writing in that, and therefore needing to sort of, I guess, just go back to first principles all the time.
Right.
And I think the move to first principles, like, what am I doing? Why am I writing this? What right do I have to write this? How can I write this in a way that feels true to my feeling and to my being, when that truth is so changeable and so unreliable and also so untransposable? It feels like that's the constant recursion. Like, I'm always just asking and asking and asking. Mm-hmm. And it's not as though the thing that is that comes out is an answer, but it's more like a dodge from the things that I feel are not answers.
Exactly. That's interesting, because I'm wondering if you were talking about these periods of inertia and movement, and I'm wondering if you were ever in the search for truth. Sometimes we get afraid of what we might find. Mm. Were you ever afraid of what you might find? The truths about yourself, about your upbringing, your family, your language?
Yeah, to be honest, it was less about the more extraneous or extra sort of juridical elements of who I was than I would be confronted by my own falseness, my own shallowness, my own venality, my own movement towards ego or pride or taking an easy out or ratiocinating that I deserved what I had, even though maybe I didn't. My smallness towards what I felt were undeserved rewards that other writing was getting. Like, there was a lot of just, I wouldn't call it self-loathing. I would just call it the boiler room of being a writer, in a sense.
Yeah.
Or all I know of being a writer.
Exactly.
Whereby I guess the difference perhaps for people who write from and on the margins is that when we're interrogating those things about ourselves, they form a much more intricate and inextricable patterning in our lives in general. Mm-hmm. And so when I talk about what does it mean to write in good faith, or what does it mean for me to invoke my past, what does it mean especially for me to invoke my ancestral past or my cultural trauma, and what responsibilities do I have, I feel like I have to confront my own potential bad faith in doing that, or at least my own ambivalence in doing that. And that's the only way I know how to do it.
That kind of annihilates ego too, when you're that honest with yourself about, this is a certain vain intention, this is a bad faith intention, this is... So it kind of begins to take ego out of the equation a little bit. I'm going to put ego back into the equation a little bit. I noticed that you opened with Alden, W.H. Alden, In the Boat, your first book, and I couldn't help but draw comparisons between you two as writers, because Alden has this amazing technical virtuosity where he can move between various forms with ease, as you do in 36 ways of writing a Vietnamese poem. He can think of, he's a thinker, he's a philosopher. There are a lot of different ways in which Alden moved in the world. And so the question is for you, I guess you have to put a little ego in here, it's okay. What were the different variations of your life that led you to being virtuosic, that led you to thinking about what are the variations in your life that mirror the variations in your text? Who were you in your previous life?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like there has never been a fixed self. I feel like I am constantly contingent and constantly
I love that.
In code and decrypting and encrypting. And I don't feel that that's, I guess, where I'm getting at, and where the book tries to nudge its way toward, is to not denigrate that as being lesser or false. Mm. I think there's a sense that is promulgated by our culture that the whole thing, the sublime thing, the coherent, unified thing, is the real thing.
Mm.
And it comes from, you know, bottom shelf Hollywood scripts and from Hallmark and from advertising. You know, it's this sense that we are inadequate because we're not feeling or seeing or being that whole, pure, blissful thing, and I think I'm sort of at the point where it's beautiful to me to be partial in many ways. It's beautiful to me to be full of doubt and provisionality and to have my position constantly sort of in flux and a process. And also to be reflexive. I don't think self-consciousness is something that is, you know, kind of bloodless and abstruse. I think it's the root condition of our way of being.
Absolutely.
You know, and so the idea that you may not be thinking something fully because you're also thinking about how you're thinking, that's not a handicap to me. That's part of the foliation of you know, our minds, which I think is a wonderful thing. So to bring it back to your question, I guess part of it is more egotistically planted. I remember a friend of mine was writing a New York Times magazine thing on Nabokov, and he asked me, hey, you know, what are your thoughts on this guy? Has he been influential? And I remember thinking about it, and one of the things that I thought was, what I liked about Nabokov's work was that it was so virtuosic. It took the language and, you know, took more of it into itself and absorbed it and, you know, digested it and percolated and, like, gamified it in a way that was incredibly virtuosic. But it gave permission for people like me because, for the most part, I mean, this was not his first language, obviously, and yet he was never, or very rarely to my knowledge, put down as being someone who was just playing games. You know, like, there was always a sense that he was also a serious guy and the stuff that he was doing was serious and that it came from, like, rootstock. And I think one of the things that I've had to, and maybe it's, you know, paranoia, but one of the things that I've had to sort of deal with is this idea that people who look like me, when they're virtuosic, they're seen as being, like, you know, piano prodigies, but without any soul, or they're seen as being imitative or industrious or, you know, excellent rote learners and things like that. Like, my friend was, a different friend was playing me Geoffrey Hill's Oxford lectures the other day, and it was him reading Hopkins' The Wind Over, and he was just reading this amazing lexical wonder. And the first thing that I thought, I sort of stopped the phone and I said, dude, you know what? If I wrote this, they would say, oh, you know, this is so well engineered. Like, it's such a a feat of, you know, imitative imagination. Which was probably, you know, who knows whether that'd be true or not. But I think that's maybe that's a chip, one of the chips on my shoulder. And so someone like Auden, someone like more Auden than Nabokov, and certainly Hopkins, they provide the space and in some ways the model for, you know, the sense that I think is true, which is we are not single, we are not unified, we are not in agreement with ourselves.
Absolutely. And the self can move, I'm going to take this off of the stand, the self can move in a lot of different ways. And it has a certain agility, right? And so we see that with your work too, because you've moved between prose and poetry, which are different modes of thinking, right? Different modes of craft. So the question I had was whether or not you felt like poems allow you to say what you can't say in prose, or whether prose, or to say it in a way you can't necessarily say it in prose, because obviously the attention is at the sentence level rather than at the line level. But what does poetry allow for you that prose doesn't?
I would love to hear your take on this too, because the way in which you sort of interweave prose and poetry, that in my view, it sort of multiplies the valencies of each. I guess the way I've been thinking about it is in part that I just like being new at things. So I was joking to a friend that maybe I would just do debuts like all my life. So I've done short stories. I've done a little essay collection, debut poetry, debut novel next, debut film, who knows. But I guess it was that when I write prose, or when I have written prose, part of the, and this links back to the last question as well and the last answer, but part of the process for me writing prose is establishing authority. You know, it just feels like, okay, now I need to prove to you, the reader, that I have the authority, I have the skill, the mastery, the standing to tell this, and that you should be carried along this thing with me. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that becomes more heavily weighted than it should be in my own writing, in my own work. And I think what that translated to in a way was this sense that I either knew what I was talking about, or that I had to pretend that I knew what I was talking about, mm-hmm. in prose, because I needed, yeah. to sort of like nail it down, and I needed to control the field of suggestion that any sentence or figure would throw up. And by way of illustration, there's a line in the first poem in this book that an Australian critic recently did a review, and he said, the line is, what's Vietnamese in me could fit in a poem. And he said, you know, this is a demonstration of the writer's humiliation as well. And I read this and I thought, sure, that's legible there. But there's also 100 other feelings that are legible in that line, that the line I would have imagined is incredibly polysemic. And, you know, by saying that something can fit in a poem feels to me like it has every shade of feeling and connotation. It's lament, it's exaltation, it's wonder, and what's Vietnamese also could fill up a book. And I think if I were to write what I was thinking about in that line in prose, it would probably take a book, you know, to spell that out. Whereas in poems, you can sort of get away with, you know, leaving something just really dense and charged, and like moving against the charges exerted by the rest of the stuff around it.
Yeah, that sounds about right. It's the deployment of negative capability in the poem, right?
Totally,
It's being able to be uncertain, whereas in prose, I think because of kind of the Aristotelian narrative arcs, you feel like you've got to be moving toward some destination. Whereas with poems, you can move freely about, and you can ask a lot of questions.
Yeah.
Right?
And don't you think, like, I mean, there's a sense that a poem can be a mind, to me, in a way that is more real and representative than prose.
Yeah.
Because it has flux built into it.
Yes.
And it doesn't necessarily have a start point and an end point, a teleology, as you say.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's that plasticity that's built into the poem. And I think that's one of the things that makes poems compelling, because you never quite know where you're going to land.
Mm.
So you keep reading through to the finish to figure out where we are.
Yeah.
And it may not be where you thought that you would be. It's completely unpredictable. And that unpredictability, because of the changeability that's inside of a poem, is really compelling.
Yeah.
But that's hard, I think. I think that is, in fact, a different mode of thinking, right? Like, it's not the same mode of thinking that one would do when they're sitting and writing a prose book or writing short stories. It's a different way of thinking. So, yeah, I think if you wanted to go with the idea of start having everything be a debut.
Yeah. Have your blessing.
Having a writing life full of beginnings, that's glorious, you know?
Okay, you heard it here first.
Yeah, a writing life full of beginnings, that's fantastic. I was wondering, would you read the first poem for us?
Yeah, sure. So, again, 36 Ways of Writing a Vietnamese Poem, and this is one diasporic. And the only difference, the signal difference between the first and the second poems is the U in the first poem is capitalized, whereas it's not in the second. One, diasporic. In English, mind you. You think I write Yiknami? Shame on you. It was your violence dumbed me, smeared me, reaved me. Your war I don't remember and won't let you forget. Moved me from place and sufficiency. From everything I didn't know, I didn't know. I would have known. You would have known. Displace meant everything to me before the power went home. Shame on me. What do I know? What Vietnamese in me could fit in a poem?
What they don't see is that the fourth stanza, displacement, graciously enters. It's the second line of the fourth stanza. And it has this syllabic separation. So you really take your time with the word displacement. And it has that double meaning.
Yeah.
What does this place mean? And also displacement. So it's interesting how the book is recounting multiple displacements, right? So you go on throughout and talk about racial, ethnic, language, even memory as a sort of displacement, and how these different displacements lead to multiple types of violences, from taxonomical to linguistic to perceptual violence. And a fun fact about the collection is that 18% of the titles use violence. There's seven titles in there. There's 37 poems, 36 ways of writing a Vietnamese poem. And seven of the titles are alluding to violence, and all of those violences morph. They're different types of violences based on different types of displacement. And so I'm wondering if you might give us a little sample of that. There's something beautiful that's happening throughout the book. But in poem three, Ekphrastic, which is coupled with poem seven, if you can read those two together.
Yeah, for sure. So poem three has this really dodgy photo of my grandma. Three, Ekphrastic, self-portrait. Photo, rite of blood. Bangwai, she, in mare, in me. Monochrome, tinge of colour decay. Note, spots and blotches, a la calligraphic ink. Spilled logogram, smeared morphemes. Character cannot cohere. Note, overexposure, giving effect of flatness. Note, low contrast, giving effect of flatness. Note, lack of contour, giving effect of flatness. As if repeatedly photocopied from photocopies. Note, clothing, French aoyai, silk, if you like, with off-scented mandarin collar. It writes itself. Note, face. Full moon circle, rising from slim circle collar. Hair flat, conforming, acceptant of path of totality. What the photo cannot say. Are her eyebrows painted tongue green? Is that smudge on her brow actually gold foil in the Southern Dynasty style? Her unseen teeth, black lacquered, all in the look. Note, expression, inscrutable, impassive, passive as craters, scuffs on jade terrace. Now write about it what you like.
Just what a way to end. Yes, that's worthy of every clap and applause.
Oh, seven, okay. It was seven.
Seven.
Yep. That you want, yeah, okay. This is longish, so forgive me. Seven, violence, pedo affective, slam declension. But think about the children, super cute children, mute children, with uncommonly big eyes, children with hard eyes, eyes that have seen what no child's eyes should see. Children naked as the day, wearing big smiles and no smiles, preternaturally wise, with mooned-out tummies and cleft palates and cataracts, deformities and birth defects, children in an instant blown up, grown up, orphaned, homeless, hard up, hopped up, ganged up, pimping on bright continental terraces and in dark, dingy rooms, their bang-bang sisters, who are children too, all children of GI boom boom, of R&R, rock and ruin, rape and run. And have you ever fucked a green man girl? You'll fly so high, you'll see stars going boom boom, boom boom. Or some of them, somehow, break free. You'll see them in red crescented refugee camps with bowl cuts and fly swarmed eyes, eyes that have seen what no, etc. Some somehow accepted into Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic, weird countries where, before long, they're given new, weird names and they're picked on, picked last, left out, looked through, looked at too long. Called slant or chink or nip or ching chong, eyes stretched to flatline squint, or told they stink, the house too, their food. What's that even in it? Hide your dogs, quick, whatever. Ha, you don't belong. Go back to where you came from. Or exoticized the girls, Hello Kittied, yellow faced, extolled for almond eyes and white adjacent skin, genetically slim, with waists two hands could circumscribe, as though designed for certain discernments. Hypersexualized, and they are children. And the boys, the men, also in their yellow bodies, brawnless, gormless, beardless, or Fu Manchu'd, good at maths, computer games, maybe even kung fu, which, though, come on, in a real fight, in turn, desexualized. Never fully anything. Essentialized into nothing. Ever orphaned from mother country and tongue, generations of family and flowering net ropes of filial piety, 3 degrees of piety, 5 foulings, where, what, we risk our lives and bring you here to study, what is it, communications? Where you think you're so good you can come here and say thank you to your parents? For cleaner guilt and adulteration, of course, chase the dragon, shoot the horse. Weird, this place. Which these children know is no place, not their place, which has them represent, but who and what for? For if not white, nor are they of colour, not fully, more or less, off colour, off white, their concerns, like all things made in Asia, inferior, knocked off, mass manufactured, low rent. Think of the children, trying, playing their part, which is no part, or a rote token part, a strenuous decor, to be praised, paid, patronized, their names mispronounced as though being done a favour, and they are, and thank you, really, for even trying, while being impressed upon re-Vietnam on our recent trip with its beautiful people, with their palm hats and their resilience and, I hope it's okay to say, their unbelievable capacity for forgiveness. And what if not this is assimilation? Though not acceptance, no amount of East-West fusion achieves that. Having it, all of it, be okay, I suppose. Accepting it all, forgiving all, taking heed and being sensitive to all, being unbelievably composed, above all, composed.
Beautiful. Thank you. So it's interesting, the imperialist mindset would have one believe that displacement is a form of salvation, right? Mm. But for the dispossessed, for those who are displaced, it is seen as a sort of violence. It is a violence. But was there ever a time for you where you didn't think of it that way? And did you come to the idea of displacement as violence later?
Hmm. You know, there's a line in, I've forgotten which one now. I think it's like Canon Horae Canonicae, mm-hmm. Where Auden says, bless what there is for being. Mm. And to me, that's what growing up was. It just was. I didn't think there was anything else. I didn't have a frame of reference. I didn't have any sense of what was out there. So I wasn't thinking, oh, here are the pathologies and here are the etiologies of, you know, my position and my parents vis-a-vis. I feel like that was something that sort of came a bit later. And I've got a really iffy relationship with retrospective family scripts, because I think I've had experience with scripts being rewritten in a way that might seem to honour an idea or ideology of, you know, this was really hard for us because we were the victims of this particular thing, and therefore here were the privations that were visited upon us. And to me, my childhood was, like a lot of people's, just really mixed. And there was joy and there was fun and humour and there was, you know, a lot of being dissed and pissed on. Like, it was just, it was a normal childhood in many cases. And, you know, I've talked to people from better material conditions than me, and they also had their own sort of shadowed and nuanced childhoods. Which is not to say that there weren't moments that I was aware of something beneath the veil, or even aware of the veil sort of existing, mm-hmm. and then sort of seeing beneath it a little bit. And so those moments, some of which were racially inflected, and many of which cast my parents in a role that was not what I was brought to believe was the parental role, namely, you know, just pedestal and mm-hmm. super, they really shook me up. And so I guess all of my experience of displacement being violent was in a way sort of vicariously visited.
That's beautiful. I mean, I think that I'm wondering if so much of childhood is a matter of looking back and seeing both the light and the shadow at the same time, mm-hmm. and recognizing both of those in their fullness makes a full and complete portrayal of what it is to be anything in the world. Yeah. You know, it's not just one particular experience, but what it is to be anything in the world is thinking fully about both aspects of it. And we get that through your work. There's this completeness inside of it. There's also this question, though, like there's a resistance. Like in the poetry book, for instance, I feel like you apply resistance to that famous Audre Lorde quote, "For you cannot dismantle the master's house with the master's tools." Mm. But what happens if language is the master's tool, but we're using it as our weapon? And what happens when language becomes the way in which you deal with the philological violences that are inherent in language? And I feel like that's what you're doing. You're using language to combat the violences of language.
Yeah.
How did you come to that? What sparked you to do that?
I think, in a way, before I read up and wised up a bit about the more theoretical underpinnings of the violence of language, mm-hmm. and in language, both historical and philological, as you say, I had an experience of language being, or English for me, being a place that I was never unwelcome. And I mean that through when I was reading. When I was reading, I felt outmastered, you know, outdone, but I didn't feel unwelcomed. I felt like I could take what I didn't know and learn it. And then from that, learn some more and other stuff and sort of find my enchantment in different things. And my love affair with the English language far predated, you know, my interrogative relationship with it. And I have to say that to the extent that I felt welcome in the English language, I can't honestly say that about any place where the English language is spoken, not to a fundamental degree. And we've talked about this a little bit even earlier about, you know, the idea of someone like me being, you know, fluent in English is already a suspicious kind of thing. There's a there's a veneer of artifice that is just a film that's laid over that from the get-go. So for me, the idea of language being, I mean, language was a technology that was invented to keep track of grain and slaves. You know, it was founded with violent intentions. And if you follow the English language, you're basically following a history of bloodshed and rapine and conquest. And you're also following an enormously sort of motley crew of different peoples coming in and imposing themselves, you know, miscegenating the language, so to speak. And so this idea that, that we have now, that it's just a very clear, pure, white, Anglo-colonial, imperialist sort of artifact, is actually totally at odds with the mongrelization and the continual sort of violence being done within the language itself as well. Because language is, you know, it's a dictionary is a site of massacre. There are words and usages that are just taking over other ones and, you know, misusing, misprisoning other sort of meanings and usages as well. Like, it's really interesting. And so for me, that doesn't necessarily translate to something that is normatively bad. I think it's completely contextual in a way. And, you know, in the poems, I sort of talk to this concept of violence being the first generation, like it's the first generative thing. Mitosis is the first act of life reproducing. A cell splits, is reaved into. Energy is formed within those cells through mitochondrial action when something is actually taken and combusted or burned or broken down, denatured, deformed into something else. You know, it's all action, it's all work, it's all process. And now I'm just enthralled by that, and I just want to see or try to do work that recognizes that kinetic dynamic of language.
Right on.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because for those that don't know, you were a lawyer in
a previous
life. And so that is a field that's dedicated to language as well. And then you moved and went to Iowa and you started working on the boat. So there's always been for you some degree of moving through the world and having your finger on the pulse of language somehow. How did your legal training, this book is precise, this collection is precise, and I say that as a high holy compliment, because the level of detail, the structure, and I read it and I thought, this is written by a mind that understands. It felt like a mind that understands legal language. It felt like a mind that understands creative language. It felt like a mind that understands all different types of languages and how they move and act on us. How much of your previous training did you pull into this? Or did you think about it? Sometimes it's not even a conscious action.
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to Greg Pardlow just earlier today about this, and the answer is as unsatisfactory now as it was then. The answer is basically I don't know. That I remember I went into the law partly because my family would not have allowed me to not go into the law because I was already not going into med, which was a big deal, but also because I wanted it. I wanted the law. Like, I wanted to have just to have it, and I knew I didn't want to do it. But I wanted to have it just for me and my family and et cetera. And when I was studying it and when I was practicing it for a little time, it was funny because all the people that I was working with, they all seemed to be closet novelists. They all wanted to write creative writing. And they all had like this pretty reflexive disdain for legal language. For the dryness and the bureaucraties, the legalese. And granted, 98% of legal language is just mind-numbingly dumb and bad.
Oh, gosh, I think just the opposite.
Really?
Love it.
But I was going to say, like 98% of everything is mostly not very great. And the stuff that is good in the law, it's so interesting. Like it just, you know, especially reading seminal dissents or you know, reasons for judgment, even reading statements of claims or writs. But the language that is being deployed in a way that is always aware that it is instrumentalized, I think it's almost, it feels like it's operating in better faith often than a lot of creative language, which is pretending to do something else, but is using all of the sort of the credit from it. So the idea that this language has a utility, and then the concomitant idea that there are ambiguities that need to be really tightly controlled in the law, where you need to have something that is elastic enough to admit changes of interpretation with adapting to different times, but is also strong enough to withstand assault, you know, on multiple fronts. That's hard. And when it's done well, it's like a mathematical proof. It's so beautiful. It's really elegant. So I was the Pollyanna sort of in law school and at the law firm saying, like, you've got to read this. Like, this is, look at that sentence, that really beautifully constructed. I don't know that I brought that into my subsequent writing, but I think that the relationship that one has as a writer with ambiguity, especially in poetry, is it's almost the first order of business. You know, it's the first rule. And so I think knowing that language is always inadequate and will always fail in a sense, but yet also knowing that language will always be able to say more than we can know, the tension between those two things is where we work.
It is, and it's a hard negotiation, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's always fascinating, I think, to move back into it and feel like you have some, you can be the god of your own little small province, you know, with words.
Yeah.
And that feels like there's some power that's inherent in that. I don't think that we do it because of power. We do it because we're in search of new beginnings.
Yeah.
Or new things to say or new ways to say them. But speaking of that, I've got a number of different questions. So I'm gonna skip over some of them and go into what I think is one of the more critical questions. You know, I geeked out on your structure of the book. I love structure. When I think about how poetry books come together, I start to think about Greg Orr's Four Temperaments. And he says there's story, there's structure, there's music, and there's imagination. Mm-hmm. And the well-balanced poem sits somewhere in the middle, kind of in this equilibrium with all four quadrants. And I experienced that with your work. But one of the things I noticed was that it's 36 ways of writing a Vietnamese poem, and there's 37 poems. It's sectionless. So it reads as both a list poem and one long poem. And I was thinking about what that does when you structure a book in that way. What it does is it kind of emphasizes the contemplation, it emphasizes the rumination, it emphasizes the persistence of the questions that are being asked. And how did you know that that was the direction that you wanted to go with the book? When did the title come in? Do you write the titles of the poems first and then work yourself into the poem, or do you work the poem and then work the title? Mm-hmm. So all of these things are kind of critical as you're putting together a collection, because you're trying to think how they cohere. So the question is, how did you make these cohere? Did you always know it was just a long poem? That's impossible to do, but did you always know it was going to be a long poem?
I think I knew. So it started as a file on my computer pre the boat, as a file entitled Eight Ways of Writing a Vietnamese Poem.
So this came first?
Yeah. I mean, poetry's always come first.
Huh.
Yeah, and it's been, yeah. But that was a very different thing. The Eight Ways file, it was, I've called it a burn file. It was a place, a repository for every time I was frustrated with how you know, an Asian poem was, I felt, taking shortcuts or, you know, just acting in not the best of faith. That's where I would sort of just like, you know, concentrate and distill my frustration or irritation with it and sort of stick those notes and those fragments into that. So that was never intended to really be anything. It was inchoate in a sense. It was kind of just like a sump. Mm-hmm. And when I started thinking about this as a thing, I realized the primary attitude behind the eight ways was, it was negative, it was born of frustration, and it was satirical, you know, parodic, sardonic. It was just coming from that particular sort of slice of the limbic pie. And when I started writing this stuff, I was like, oh no, that's not even remotely the truth for me. You know, when I think about these ways of writing the poems, I feel the whole gamut of things. I feel like a need to deeply dignify and cherish, you know, the work that has been done in that particular form or with that particular device. I feel a need to, you know, to honour and dignify the material that often is tropic or made tropic or cliched. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I feel the need to be really honest about this whole economy of bad faith that can operate around some of these kinds of writing. And so, to answer your question, the figures that were in mind for me when I was structuring this thing were, one, that in as much as I could, I needed each poem to work on as many frequencies and tones as possible, so you could read something as a straight satire and it would be strong enough to withstand that read. But then if you wanted to, like, you know, get your nuts off looking for illusions and stuff, you know, you could do that too, and everything in the middle, like, it would. But the other things were that I really wanted them to exert influence upon each other. And so there's a sense of the 36th and then 37th being, if you think of it this way, as being sort of, you know, paratactical. It's like one and then two and then three and then four. But then I wanted the whole thing to exist in a hypertactical sort of structure where there's every single one of them was destabilizing or like repositioning and reprisming the other ones. Mm-hmm. And so then it just became, it was less top-down than a constant sort of, I wanted this thing to be as precarious and delicate as possible so that it felt like it could just collapse or trapdoor. But then if you were to sort of move in, you could find a new standing and a new architecture and maybe sort of like reconsider what you just thought, you know, one poem ago or two lines ago as well. So it was just a sense of, you know, jerry-rigging it in a sense.
It's a beautiful jerry-rig.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you. Two quick things. First, I just wanted to say that I've been teaching the short story Love and Honor and Pity and Pride and Compassion and Sacrifice every year for almost a decade now. And every year, students get something out of it that I could never have imagined that they'd get out of it. So thank you for many extraordinary conversations that I've had with that many students. And every year I get something out of it that I didn't think it still had things to teach me, and it always does, so thank you. My question is that I feel like I've heard a lot of writers who write at the margins or writers who would be considered minority community writers say, write as if you are the majority, write as if you are not writing from the margins. And I think that the spirit of that advice is extraordinary and beautiful. The practice of that advice, however, is much more complicated. And I was wondering if you had thoughts on what the sort of practicality of that advice could mean.
Yeah, I've heard that too. And I agree with you. I think it comes from, you know, a spirit of empowerment and affirmation. I also think, and it sounds like you might be in the same page, that it's also beside the point, because we don't live in that structure. And every single force that has been exerted upon us as writers, as readers, as thinkers, as citizens, has reinforced that structure. And so I think the danger for me, I guess, is just any sense of, personally speaking, of fixity or certainty, because I think once you go there, it's very easy to move into piety or into instrumentalization, which I think is the opposite of what I'm interested in doing or interested in doing as a reader as well. And weirdly, the best, you know, the writers that seem most often invoked when it comes to sort of social justice activism and equity, if you go into their bodies of work and into the actual work itself, it's incredibly ambivalent, nuanced, and fully complected about all of these sorts of issues as well. And that gives me hope, because it makes me think that there is still a sense of strength and truth that comes out from this, even if we're just siphoning off, you know, the wrong part of the prism.
So if you had felt the desire to write this book in Vietnamese, is your Vietnamese good enough that you could have? And also, will it be translated into Vietnamese? And I'm trying to ask myself, how would people in Vietnam maybe prefer it to enter them? I would imagine, well, you know, every time something's translated, it changes. But it sounds to me like the richness of the English language is something that you are well fluent with and comfortable with, and you know what you can do with English because of its richness. So are there plans for this, and would it seem, from your point of view, desirable for this to be even translated into Vietnamese?
I don't read or write Vietnamese, so I couldn't say, and I wouldn't be able to talk to how they might respond to a potential translation. I can say that I was talking to someone in the publishing house about this recently, that this feels very resistant to translation because it is so in and of the language, as you say. But that said, I was saying to this guy, you know, just tell the translators that they don't have to actually try to translate it. Like, just play with it. Do what you think this thing is doing, when it's doing it or how it's doing it. And if it does it differently in your language, then do it that way. I would be really excited to know that that's out there. My skill in every other language is so non-existent or so bad that I wouldn't actually be able to appreciate it. But the knowledge that it's out there would just be gravy, I think.
Thank you so much for reading your poems aloud. I was kind of struck by one particular word in both the first poem and the second one that you read, which I think is poem number 3, which is just the use of the word smeared, which was really surprising in the context that it was in. And so I have 2 questions, and the first was just, what does that word mean to you, or what does it evoke for you? And the second is, I think you were talking about building poems that can be read in multiple different ways, and you've got this immense precision in your language. And how do you incorporate surprise and funkiness and in your word choice or in other ways as well? Because it was really effective.
Cheers. Yeah, that really good pickup. The word smear and reeve appear, you know, throughout the book. I think it's 3 occasions. Every single one of my editors has picked it up and said, was this intentional? I'm like, yep, it was. To me, I mean, the major 2 meanings for me of smear, one is, you know, to impugn, you know, to calumnize someone, to tarnish them, you know. And the other one is this sort of sense, which the book also goes into, of but close enough. It's this sense that when it comes to stuff that is other, or else, and in this case, Asian, you know, none of us are really across it, because that's kind of the point. Like, we come from a tradition where I could name 20 Greek heroes and most people in this room would have heard of most of them, but I couldn't name 20 Vietnamese mythological heroes, and none of you would have heard. I'm smearing you now. Like, maybe you're like all across it, but I'm just I'm assuming. And so there is this sense that, you know, that this supposition of who you are or how you are is something that can so easily sort of just be, you know, spread like paint across a palette. To me, it feels like a really interesting exercise as well, and a physical metaphorization of what happens. Because when you do smear paint across a palette, what ends up happening is like surprise and striation. Like, it can be really freaking pretty. And to the second point, I think what I would say is I am all for surprise. And what probably my intention is I'm eschewing first order surprise. So just like surprise of, oh, that non sequitur is really interesting, or that incongruence of image is really surprising. That tends to lose its charge on subsequent reads. And what I would hope for would be surprises that happen sort of within the reads themselves, so that a thing or a word or an image or an understanding that is taken in a certain way might be recast at a later stage or by a different poem or on subsequent reads. I'm hoping that's the case.
I'm going to take the privilege of asking the last question. We just have one more question. And that is, when you are writing from a marginalized group, we often have to hold a banner that we did not consent to hold. And so as a writer from any marginalized group, one of the things that you have to work against is essentialization. And so how do you resist being essentialized by the logics of reductive logics? How do you do that when you're writing from a certain perspective or about a certain experience?
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, I don't think you can. I think that's the bind. I think what you can do is you can show the bind. You can show, you know, the structures and the tethers that tie. And I guess part of the project for me is, if you look at it really reductively, let's say there are certain tropes that are essentialized or orientalized, you know, and so in some of the poems I sort of go into them, you know, the long silk hair and like the helicopter thudding for the war, silk, jade, moon. And I guess one way that has happened and has a fair bit of legs is a resistance and an aversion to those tropes and to those moves, right? And so a lot of writers, really great writers, just steer clear of that stuff because they're like, that's not us, that's not me, so don't expect me to talk about or write about this thing. And to me, that feels like a capitulation, because that stuff always has some unspent charge in it,
yeah.
You know? And it's also if it's your stuff, it's your stuff. You know, no one's gonna be able to take that away from you. So part of the project for me is, I guess, reclamative. You know, it's trying to bring those things into life again in a way that is meant and yours, but that is also open to the cliches and the tropes that abound around it. So like that long poem that I read before, the slam declension, to me, that's, you know, there's very much a tongue-in-cheek all the way through it, because it's kind of like, well, you want this? Here it is. You got it. You know, I'm just going to like ladle it on, all of the sort of like the tropes one after the other. But if I did that just like that, to me, that would be an arid exercise. And so I want to find a way of doing it that feels to me like, oh, I'm actually going to mean this, you know, as well. And I'm going to put myself out there and in it so that I'm indicted too. I'm not standing apart and just like, you know, throwing peanuts.
I think that as a reader, that's what we get. We get that you mean it. So thank you for writing this beautiful book. Thank you for being here tonight. Thank you all for coming and listening to the conversation, 36 Ways. of writing a Vietnamese poem. Give it up for our guest.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author-events.